Good morning or afternoon for some of you, and welcome to our Alaska Collaborative on Health and the Environment teleconference on toxic chemicals in schools, health hazards to children, and what you can do. We are joined today by Claire Barnett of the Healthy Schools Network and Dr. David Carpenter of the University at Albany, State University of New York. My name is Diana DeFazio, and on behalf of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, I'll be facilitating today's call. CHE Alaska is a regional partnership group of the National Collaborative on Health and the Environment. CHE Alaska aims to advance knowledge and effective action to address growing concerns about the links between human health and environmental factors. You can find more information online at akaction.org and at healthandenvironment.org. And that's spelled out, health and environment. The call will last 1 hour, and we will have time at the end for your questions. I sent everyone who signed up for the call an email yesterday with links to our speakers' presentations. If you haven't done so already, please take a moment to download the presentations so you can follow along. They can also be accessed by going to our homepage at akaction.org and simply clicking on the title of today's call. At the top of the call page, you'll see links to both of the presentations. Now I'd like to welcome and introduce our first speaker, Claire Barnett. Claire is the founder and executive director of the Healthy Schools Network and is also coordinator of the National Coalition for Healthier Schools. The Healthy Schools Network has challenged the nation with a call to action to ensure that schools are environmentally responsible to all children, to personnel, and to communities. As a child health advocate, Claire Barnett convened the fledgling network in 1995 as a New York statewide coalition. It has since shaped and won new funds and multiple laws on school environments in the nation's third largest education system, the New York State system, and the nation's single largest school district, New York City, as well as federally, and has fostered state and regional reform coalitions. Welcome, Claire. Thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to go ahead and begin?
I will. Thank you, Diane, so much. And thank you, CHE Alaska, and thanks to Pam and everybody at Alaska Community Action Against Toxics. If you'd flip to slide 2, please. We really use 2 frameworks when we talk about the school experience and children's environmental health. The first framework, which ACAT's very familiar with, and I'm sure many of your listeners are, is that children are not just little adults. They breathe more air per pound of body weight, their skin is more permeable, they're biologically more vulnerable, they may have different exposures. And some of the indoor exposures in schools will include things like building materials and furnishings, treated wood, carpet, fabrics, products, synthetic turf, science projects, paint markers, correction fluids, and so forth. So there are a lot of exposures that take place inside the school, which is more than just exposure to the 3 R's. What we do know from some collaborative work that we did with the intellectual and developmental disabilities organizations is that children with special health or learning needs may be even more exposed and more vulnerable to hazards that they encounter. And it makes a certain amount of sense when you realize that they may have additional problems in communication, but more to the point, they may already have some health compromises. The second framework, slide 3, is that schools aren't just little offices. And I think instinctively every parent understands this, but you need to really think it through and then figure out how to use the material. First of all, about 95% of all school occupants are women and children, and those women are mostly of childbearing age. 99% of all school children actually attend school every day. That comes from the National Association of School Nurses. Schools are more densely occupied than homes or offices. And for those of you who are in an office now, look around your office space and imagine how many little children would be sitting on the floor if it were a second grade reading group. So they're much more densely occupied. They are also have many more processes and chemical uses in place in one school facility than a home would have. For example, if you have a regional school that has some pre-K programs as well as vocational programs and a print shop and a swimming pool, they're all sharing the same ventilation system, but with a very wide array of people inhaling that air. one of our difficulties that we've seen is that there's been so little federal funding available for a short amount of time that when you look across the states at who's active in the states on policy and practice regarding school environments, you don't see as much as you do for CDC's traditional school health model. Many people are very familiar with the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention school health model, which is really traditional school health education and some violence and bullying and the psychosocial environment. They've been at it for a long time. They've really invested in it with combinations of state and district grants. On the other side, though, however, on the environment side, EPA has been at it for a far shorter amount of time with less money, and the results really show up. Only about 20% to 30% of the states are active in helping districts with environmental factors. On the other hand, when it comes to psychosocial issues, about 80 to 90% of the states are active in that area. And that's based on a CDC school health survey that was in the field in 2012. Next slide. One of our signature report here is a third triennial State of the States data and policy report that our office produces with interns and many contributors, including people like Pam at ACAT. Rather than get into all the detail from all the states, I just want to share a little bit of information about Alaska that we gleaned largely from federal sources as well as from people in Alaska. And I'll move on to that in a minute. Next slide, 5. The Towards Healthy Schools report has a narrative introduction. We were able to elevate us within that a great deal of the robust literature, the published literature regarding healthy indoor environments, children's attendance and achievement and ability to learn. There are many factors in indoor environmental quality that will improve attendance and academic performance, behavior, and productivity. Poor indoor environments, frankly, are already damaging health and learning, according to the Institute of Medicine in 2011. And they also reported that indoor exposures can be 100 to 1,000 times more intense than outdoor exposures. So think that through. That means if you have diesel emissions outside or something else going on outside that is infiltrating the indoor environment, it will tend to accumulate indoors. But at the same time, you have a collection of indoor pollutants which are generated by the building materials, the products in use, and what people bring into the building themselves. So the indoor exposures are always more intense than the outdoor exposures. We also know, and I won't pay a lot of attention to it in this particular presentation, that schools are filled with asthma triggers. We know from work that took place in New York that pediatric asthma hospitalizations, the most expensive kind of care out there, can absolutely triple on returns, plural, to school during the school year. That was published by the New York State Department of Health. Next slide, 6. So we had really two key findings from the analysis of the data in the Towards Healthy Schools 2015 report. The first is that we consider, and this was a large group decision here, that all school children should be considered at elevated risk of health and learning difficulties due solely to the unexamined and or unaddressed risks in their schools and the lack of public health services for children at risk or with suspected exposures. It's a very long sentence, and there are a couple of big concepts in there. All children are at risk due solely to factors which are either nobody took a look at or nobody is paying any attention to, unexamined, unaddressed, and the lack of public health services for children at risk or with suspected exposures. The other is that we believe that justice for children can be achieved, but that really demands swifter, surer progress at many levels, certainly at the federal level, tough going for EPA and CDC, but that we really need to have them step up more robustly than they have within the states and locally. Next slide. So some of the data that we excavated out of federal sources for the state of Alaska is on this slide, slide 7. You have the number of public schools taken from the National Center for Ed Statistics, operated by the U.S. Department of Education, number of public school students, minority students, and so forth. All that is from federal data. In addition, NASB, the National Association of State Boards of Education, tracks some of the policy work. CDC tracks some of the policy work by the states, and we have been doing some as well. For advocates, there's some really interesting things to pay attention to in what's already in place. One is that you have at the State Education Department a facilities office. You need to know who's in the office, what they're doing, and what they want to do next. You're in a position of having a state that has a state-adopted OSHA plan, which means there will be some protection for public school employees within that plan. You're also lucky in Alaska because you have state grants for construction of schools, and that's terrific because not all the states do. And even those states that have had grants for school construction in the current fiscal climate have been tapering off on those or even suspending them. So it's good to find out what the money can be spent for and how projects are decided upon and how the funds are allocated. Like any good advocate, follow the money sometimes has some surprising results. It's also interesting that Alaska is a state that happens to assess school buildings. I don't happen to know how exactly they assess the buildings. We do know that no two states are alike, that it would be fun to see to what extent Alaska has a good system for assessing facility needs and environmental hazards and compliance with environmental laws. All that would fit into a facility assessment as an overall concept. At the moment, you don't have a state green cleaning law. You don't have a law on green school design, although probably about 30 states do at this point. And on green cleaning, I think it's 12 states plus the district have laws either requiring or promoting the use of green cleaning products in schools. You do have a law requiring the inspection of drinking water, which is terrific, and you do have a requirement that schools have to have IPM plans. So one of the assessment questions is to what extent are the plans implemented? Are they actually following them? Is there a compliance issue there? I'm going to turn quickly because it's hard to understand what's going on with schools when you look at them from the outside, but sometimes you're lucky enough to get some pictures from the inside. So if you'd turn to slide 8, please, and look at some of the examples of health threats in schools. And I want you to think to yourself, what toxics might be involved in any one of these situations. So the slide on the upper left,
Claire?
happens to be a closed ventilation system.
We can't hear you right now, Claire.
I'm sorry, what?
For about the last minute.
You can't hear me?
Hear you. I'm wondering if you accidentally hit your mute button.
No.
On your phone?
No. Can you hear me now?
Can those in the Anchorage office confirm that we can't hear Claire?
Oh, dear.
Oh, there you are.
This is David. I've been hearing her just fine.
You have?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm sorry for the interruption. I cannot hear her at all.
Well, is there some way that your listeners can signal you or something?
No, but I would just like to ask the Anchorage office if they could let me know if they heard the last minute.
Yes, Diana, we can hear. We've been hearing all along.
Okay, well, it must be something happened with my phone, so my apologies. Okay. Please continue.
No, that's fine. There's a bug in the system someplace. That's all
right. Okay.
Sorry.
Speaking
about
of
that. Bugs, we'll go on to the health threats in schools.
Okay.
So the upper left slide is a closed ventilation system, and you know that if you do have toxic products in use in schools, that you want good air to flush it out is one option, as well as switching out products. On the inside, in the upper right picture, is the same unit with mouse droppings sitting on top of the ventilating air outflow. And then, of course, everybody's aware of what happens with old, moldy, portable buildings that kind of crumble away. This one happens to be an abandoned classroom trailer building, but there are trailers all over in every state that probably shouldn't be used as classroom buildings, but it's a push. So some of the health threats that are represented here include mold, lead, formaldehyde, flame retardants, certainly in the trailer, and accumulated dust, which carries a lot of problems with it. Next slide, 9. Badly damaged paint and plaster on the walls and ceilings and other surfaces in an elementary school. So that could be microbial contamination, certainly lead, probably asbestos. And you don't know what else is mixed in with that. I would suspect some PCBs as well. The slide on the right is a picture of a ceiling, water-stained and damaged ceiling and wall tiles. So this exposes more than just whatever was in the ceiling tiles and the wall. It's also above in the crawl space above. Next slide, slide 10. People are certainly aware about PCBs in schools, and more so in the last few years than they have been recently. And I'm sure David is going to talk about that a little bit, so I won't dwell on the PCB issue, but they are legacy toxics, and they're in many, many different kinds of building products. On the right, we have an example taken from the U.S. EPA program that was once called the School Chemical Cleanout Program. It was defunded during the Bush years, but it's a terrific program. And some of the state environment agencies are still continuing it at a state level within their authorizations as state environment agencies. And what they do is they help schools clean up little messes like this, which are old, outdated, mislabeled chemical products, which may be highly hazardous, flammable, explosive, and so forth, and have no place in a school anymore. And down below are pesticides of many different kinds and varieties used both indoors and out. We know that parents very often find out about school exposures, but only after the fact. We know that from two surveys that we have done with the national and the state, New York State Association of School Nurses. And the most surprising part of all of that was not that they, of course, knew children who were adversely impacted by short-term acute exposures, but that they were highly reluctant to even talk about their own exposures with their own building principals and administrators, but even more reluctant to discuss those with parents. That's really a chilling piece of information. If you are a parent and you say, I have a child and we're seeing the doctor more often and we're using more meds and nobody's telling me what's going on, and well, have you checked with the school nurse? She said, no, there's nothing happening. He's the only person who's sick. The odds are, if it's a revolving door student, meaning they're healthy on Monday and sick and out on Tuesday and Wednesday, it is a school-based exposure, and it will take a great deal of digging to find out exactly what's going on. We've had many examples that we've collected over the years, and people have called us for assistance. For example, slide 11, parent from Tennessee. It actually took her 4 years of work to get her local school to stop spraying hospital-grade disinfectants around children at lunch, and it was the children who were doing the spraying. As a result of documenting this and reporting it, she was actually banned from visiting her child's school, and it took 5 months for a lawyer to get the ban revoked. That is just one of the stories that shouldn't be taking place. A Pennsylvania parent encountered her child being asked to clean up mold-damaged materials within the school itself, and it's completely inappropriate. She reached out, and the state health department, as well as the building principal, both helped her with that. And a Virginia parent talked about construction zone is exactly next to where her daughter's class runs and plays at recess. And the children are literally playing underneath clouds of dust from the construction. The school says that it wasn't a big deal, and OSHA, which is Occupational Safety and Health for Adults, was there but said they couldn't help because the workers were already wearing masks. It's just the children don't have masks, and the children are playing under the same clouds of dust. The local health department in Virginia said they would simply monitor the situation because they didn't have anything that they could do for children as well. So it's a little bit crazy to have every single state compel children to attend school, but then not pay attention to the conditions and the exposures that are taking place in these buildings. I'll skip over
slide 12, the common asthma triggers in schools. I think a lot of you are very familiar with those. But I do want to mention some of the toxics in schools, and probably David's going to amplify this. Secondhand smoke, of course, pests and pesticides, mold. Slide 14, though, amplifies this a little bit. There's certainly lots of chemical hazards embedded in cleaning products that are used every single day of the week. So it's certainly possible to switch out to safer green cleaning products. It's easy to switch off to safer pest control methods. It should be easy, but it often takes an outside expert to help schools do an inventory and dispose of old, outdated chemicals, as well as use safer disinfectants. There's new research that we have published and others have published on using safer disinfectants in schools to use as directed in high-touch areas. The other opportunity all of you have to address toxics is to understand what is being assessed in the buildings when your state says it has a way to assess buildings, to understand what those assessments look like, what the renovation funds can tackle, and then see if there is a way to use the existing authorizations and funding streams to identify and remediate existing hazards like lead and PCBs and the site pollutants and asbestos that come with many, many old buildings. In the end, whatever the money is spent on, the community, the parents, the children, the teachers certainly, want to know that the investment has created a greener, healthier school building that's easy to clean and to maintain. I want to focus a little bit on some good news out there. We and our partners established a national collaborative work group on green cleaning and chemical policy reform in schools several years ago, and it's been a wonderful tool. So we just updated the website, and slide 15 is a shot of the new website. And it contains two different toolkits now. So we're probably going to have to change the web name, but I'm not sure how we go about doing that at the moment. So we have a green cleaning toolkit, which is the old toolkit, also cleaned up and kind of streamlined with good information, including a worker training module done for us by AFSCME, International Union, and linking to the safety data sheets that are part of the globally harmonized system. And the second toolkit is on healthy products for healthy schools. So in that, we're really tackling a wider array of green products. They are certified, they are greener, they are healthier, they're available, and they're often at same or lower cost. I happen to be sitting in a state, New York State, which has had a green procurement program for the state agencies for a number of different years. Probably since almost 6 years now. And they've come out with a recent report this year showing again that the state has saved over $100 million in a year just by buying green products. So it's the upfront cost. So this is a good news item. And I want to mention about the other products in reducing the chemical load inside a building because of a terrific work that was done by the Northeast Independent School District in San Antonio, Texas. They implemented EPA's premier indoor air quality tools for schools program to clean up indoor air. The district also adopted environmentally preferable purchasing. And so when they do classroom assessments, they're looking at the cleaning program, they're looking at the smart material selection, they're also tracking kids with asthma by classroom. And for those classrooms that have a high proportion of children with asthma, they go in and they actually inspect the individual classroom for asthma triggers. And this will include switching out some of these product types that are commonly found in schools, which may not need to be there, for which there are safer substitutes. So it's a very targeted kind of intervention program that has had tremendous success. And we really recommend Northeast Independent to all of you. Their weather isn't what yours is, but the program is really ready to replicate, and it's very exciting work to take a look at. And with that, I will turn it over to David. And Diane, if you want to introduce David, and we'll hear about some of the heavy-duty toxics inside schools.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you so much. Yes, now I'd like to introduce Dr. David Carpenter. Dr. Carpenter is a public health physician who serves as director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University at Albany. He is also a professor of environmental health sciences at UAlbany School of Public Health. Dr. Carpenter is an internationally recognized expert on polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, and public health. He has worked successfully with many communities across the country to help them assess the degree of human exposure to PCBs, including working with communities on St. Lawrence Island, Alaska. He previously served as director of the Wadsworth Center of the New York State Department of Health and as dean of the University at Albany School of Public Health. Dr. Carpenter, who received his medical degree from Harvard Medical School, has more than 370 peer-reviewed publications, 6 books, and 50 reviews and book chapters to his credit. Welcome, David.
Thanks very much. And let's get right into this. I work closely with Claire and Healthy Schools Network, as well as with ACAT, so this is sort of all in the family. What I decided to do, since Claire was giving a good general introduction to the range of concerns in schools, I'm going to focus my attention specifically on exposures in schools that have the potential to interfere with learning. So the second slide just lists a variety of exposures that are known to alter cognitive function in kids. And not all of these are ones you're going to see in schools. Methylmercury, for example, is only found primarily in fish. Arsenic and manganese are widespread in soils, but you're not going to get those a lot in schools. Lead, PCBs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, they certainly can be in schools. Hopefully there's nobody smoking in the school, but the kids may be exposed to environmental tobacco smoke at home. And Claire's already mentioned pesticides, which can reduce cognitive function. So the next slide just shows how children are exposed to these chemicals. Well, ingestion of food and drink is the best recognized route of exposure. And this makes it very important what's fed in the cafeteria, what's in the machines in the hallways, if they're still there, which they shouldn't be. But contamination of food and drink is a very important thing. Some organic chemicals can be absorbed through the skin. And this is important in a whole variety of things, from cosmetics to just waste oils that are around. But inhalation is a very important route of exposure that has not been appreciated as being as important as it in fact is. And inhalation can be breathing in dust from all kinds of activities, but it also can be breathing in chemicals that volatilize and go in the air. You know, most people think when you spray for pesticides in the cracks and around the corners of the floor, that those pesticides stay there, but that is not the case. They slowly go into the air, and if you're in the room, you're going to be breathing them as long as you're in the room. Now, they may kill roaches and ants and spiders, but they certainly don't do anything positive to kids or adults. And the fact that they are breathed in is important to understand. Now, there are some other exposures listed in the next slide that also can reduce learning. Just noise, a racket from construction outside. Poor lighting, where kids have to squint to see, can reduce learning ability. And excessive radio frequency electromagnetic fields, which I'll talk about a little bit more a bit later. So the next slide, I want to talk specifically about ADHD or attention deficit disorder, which is more common in girls, whereas ADHD is more common in boys. Everybody that is in a school, every teacher, every administrator, knows about the kids that are always in trouble, that can't pay attention, that disrupt the learning of the whole classroom because they're overactive, they're impulsive, they do things that they just can't sit still. Now, you know, some people think that ADHD is just bad child behavior. Unfortunately, that seems not to be the case. ADHD is a syndrome that's triggered by exposure to certain environmental contaminants, and the time when children are exposed can even be before birth. So it isn't always that the exposure takes place in the schools, although often it does take place in the schools. So many of the children with ADHD do have other disorders such as autism or dyslexia or conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, but some of those are associated with learning disability. But in the next slide, the risk factors for ADHD, ADHD is much more common in boys than girls, about three times as common. And it can appear primarily in families where they're not given proper nutrition, where there's maternal stress. And as I already indicated, a lot is dependent on pre- and postnatal exposure to environmental chemicals. The better educated the parent, the less likely the child is to have ADHD, which reflects both better nutrition, probably lower stress, and less exposure to environmental contaminants. In the next slide, we note that ADHD is not usually associated with great reductions in intelligence, but still kids with ADHD do poorly on cognitive function tests. And, you know, that really doesn't, that's not surprising, because how can you learn if you don't pay attention? So the problem in the kid with ADHD is they can't do two things at once. They start something, they get distracted and go to something else. And so it really is a matter of cognitive flexibility. Ability to switch attention from one thing to another is very reduced in the child with ADHD. Now, Claire has already mentioned concern about lead in PCBs, especially in older schools. And I think just about everybody knows that lead reduces IQ. And that dates from studies started by Herb Needleman back in the late 70s. I'm not going to show that slide, but I am showing one slide from his papers in that time, which shows that the ability of kids to pay attention, or in the left bars show distractibility, in relation to how much lead is in the baby teeth of the child. And the higher the lead level, the more distractible the child. And if you go across, the less persistent, the more dependent, the less organized, the more hyperactive, the more impulsive, the more frustrated, the more of a daydreamer, the more being unable to follow directions and having a low overall performance in relation to lead exposure. Now, where can one be exposed to lead? Well, we used to have lead in gasoline. So in old schools, there still will be lead in the soil outside of the schools. Lead was added to paint for many, many years and still is present in some paints, especially those imported from China. And so old schools that have old paint that's chipping can be a source of exposure. We used to use lead pipes for water supplies, and there was a major issue in the District of Columbia not that long ago where old lead pipes were still in place and lead levels were elevated in some of the homes and some of the schools as well. But the next slide shows that you get the same profile of abnormal behaviors when you're exposed to PCBs. And this shows decreased IQ, impulsivity, attention problems, poor school performance, deviant social behavior, and even blurring of gender-specific behaviors. And that's because PCBs have activity that mimics estrogen, the female sex hormone. In the next slide, you see ability of kids in relation to their PCB level in their blood for full-scale IQ, for verbal IQ, for freedom from distractibility and from verbal comprehension. And the higher the kid's exposure to PCBs, the poorer they do on all of these functions. Now, Claire did mention PCBs in schools, and just last week I was at a meeting in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, focused specifically on this issue. This is an issue that's gotten a lot of attention in New York City. It's beginning to get some attention in California, especially in Malibu. And it seems that the rest of the world is totally oblivious to this, or at least the rest of the U.S. Old schools that were constructed before about 1980, had PCBs used in a variety of building materials. PCBs were the solvent in oil-based paints. So old paint, if it hasn't been removed or covered over, has PCBs that slowly go into the air as they volatilize. Old fluorescent lights had ballasts, which are basically like capacitors, and they were filled with pure PCBs. We've had a situation in New York City where a student had pure PCBs dripping on her head coming from the light ballast. And PCBs were used as a solvent for the caulk that was used around windows and doors and seams everywhere. And my office is an old building, and there was caulk hanging down on the outside, which we analyzed, and it was just loaded with PCBs. Now, the problem is that current standards, the US EPA has a standard for PCBs in caulk, and if it's more than 50 parts per million, it's legally hazardous waste and must be removed and remediated. Many schools built in that period of time almost certainly have PCBs in the caulk, but they're afraid to test it because if it comes back over 50 parts per million, they're going to be stuck with the costs of taking it out. And this is a major problem. EPA is aware of the issue. The situation in New York City, as more study was done, it appeared that the easier problem to deal with, and probably the most serious threat, was the PCBs coming from the ballast and the fluorescent lights. These were old fluorescent lights. They should have been replaced long ago. They weren't because no school has enough money. And so they're inefficient in terms of energy utilization, but they're also a real danger because when they've been there so long, these ballasts degrade and release PCBs into the air. This issue does need attention in every state in the union and in every school that was built before about 1980. PCB production in the U.S. was outlawed in 1976, although remaining stocks were used after that. But schools built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s are very likely, almost guaranteed, to have some of these problems of PCBs in light ballasts if they haven't all been removed, and PCBs in caulk. The PCBs in caulk may not be as serious an issue in terms of contributions to PCBs in the indoor air. But again, kids in a classroom with elevated PCBs in the air are going to be breathing them continuously. They're going to go into their body. They're going to reduce IQ. They're going to cause shortened attention span. All of the things you do not want to have. And the next slide simply shows lead and PCBs in terms of how they affect the various domains that are part of ADHD. Memory, response inhibition, cognitive flexibility, planning and attention, all adversely affected. And the evidence is strong both in humans and animals for both lead and PCBs. So again, problems particularly in older schools. Now, it isn't just schools, of course. It's older homes. It's older office buildings, and a kid that lives in a home built in that period is likely to have PCBs there as well. So it's a major issue. To go on, Claire mentioned the use of pesticides, and certain pesticides also reduce cognitive function. This next slide is from a report that looked at organophosphate pesticides, which are very commonly used in schools and in homes, and it shows that the excretion of the metabolite, these organophosphates, they're not like the PCBs. They don't stay in your body forever, but they are broken down and you can be exposed to them on a daily basis. And the metabolites are excreted in the urine. So this looks at the breakdown products of organophosphate pesticides in the urine. And you see that the higher the concentration, the poorer the full-scale IQ in the kid. So that's another reason why green cleaning pesticides and green products are so important, especially in schools, but also everywhere else. So what are the long-term consequences of exposure to these contaminants? Well, if you have ADHD as a child, whether that exposure is from before birth, before school, or during school years, usually ADHD continues for life to one degree or another, at least in half of people that have ADHD as a child. And this results in a reduced ability to deal with frustration, an increased risk of antisocial activity, and that results in even an increased risk of getting into legal trouble. So the next slide talks about early life exposure to environmental chemicals as a risk factor for crime. And it's really quite striking how strong this evidence is that if your blood lead is high at 6 years of age, you're more likely to get arrested for violent crime when you're an adult. My colleague, Rick Nevin, has looked at the historic use of lead in gasoline and arrests for crime 20 years later, and that's shown in the next slide. Now, the black lines at the top are the amount of lead that was used in gasoline over a period of time that ended in the early 80s. Now, the red bars are the arrests for violent crime that are overlaid, but with an overlay of 20 years. So most little kids don't get arrested, but when they get to be 20 years of age, they might be. And what you see is the rates of crime overlay quite nicely if you do this 20-year shift, which is to say that that exposure early in life, whether it be in this case from lead to gasoline or for other sources, does increase the risk that a person will be frustrated, be more likely to do something impulsively later in life. Now, the next slide makes the point that there have been a number of studies that show that the relationship between cognitive function measured by IQ and the concentrations that result in shortened attention span and antisocial behavior are the same. Now, this is something very interesting, something I've been interested in studying for a long time. We know a lot about the parts of the brain that are responsible for IQ, but we don't know nearly as much about the parts of the brain responsible for attention span and antisocial behavior and ability to deal with frustration. It's been studied best for lead, but it's likely that all of these chemicals that reduce IQ also have these effects on behavior. There's a lot of evidence for that in PCBs, but some of the others haven't been studied so well. All right, let me talk a little bit about radiofrequency radiation, because this is an emerging issue that is important, and it's important in schools. There is a strong body of evidence that people that use cell phones for long periods of time, holding the cell phone to their ear, are more at risk of developing brain cancer. And furthermore, that children under the age of 20 are more at risk than older people, and the risk seems to decline with time. Now, a child on a cell phone isn't going to develop cancer while they're still in school, but it may be 10 or 15 years later. But there is also evidence, again, strong evidence, that men that wear their cell phone in their belt or in their pants pocket have reduced sperm counts and greater incidence of infertility. Nobody's looked at exposure of children to see what their reproductive potential is years later, but that's a concern. And the next slide raises an even more controversial issue, which is the syndrome of electrohypersensitivity. Many people, both children and adults, now appear to be sensitive to exposure to radio frequency radiations. These are the things from cell phones, from cell towers, from smart meters, from Wi-Fi. And they get symptoms of headaches, dizziness, anxiety, ringing in the ears, and poor attention. Now, the specific issue in schools is everybody agrees that kids must have access to the internet. They need to be able to learn and use modern technology. But schools increasingly are creating electronic classrooms, computer classrooms, where There'll be a whole pile of kids on iPads or laptops with one industrial science rudder at the top. This results in very high radio frequency levels and certainly is going to increase the risk of cancer, reduce fertility, and subject some children to electrohypersensitivity. What's the solution? Well, if you have a wired computer, you don't use radio frequency radiation. So it's not that it's that difficult to prevent this exposure. And yet most school administrators and teachers and parents are not even aware of this potential danger. I think we'll hear a lot more about this as time goes on. But in the meanwhile, the whole world seems to be heading full speed ahead in making everything wireless and not being very cognizant of the potential hazards. So in conclusion, in the last slide, schools are places where children go to learn. Claire covered a whole variety of other things, asthma triggers, allergies, infections, other threats to the health of a child in school. But I've focused my attention specifically on those chemicals that are known to interfere with cognitive function. We really need to get these things out of schools because the whole purpose of having a kid go to school is to learn. And if they're going to be exposed to things in schools that will cause a reduction in IQ, a shortened attention span, an inability to pay attention, how can they learn? The exposure to radio frequency radiation is a new threat. It's much less well documented, but it is increasingly being shown to be a very real threat that does have significant potential to interfere with the ability of children to learn and grow into productive and responsible adults. So I'll stop there, and I think we're going to go on to a session of questions.
Yes, exactly right. Thank you, David. This is the time in our call when we open the lines for your questions and comments. So we have about 10 minutes to build on what we've learned and talk with our guest presenters. So if you would like to ask a question, please press star 2 to unmute your line. Please also state your name and affiliation and be brief enough that we can get to a few of your questions before the end of the hour. Thank you. Again, you simply press star 2 to unmute your line, and you can direct your questions to Claire or David or both of them.
We were so clear, nobody has any questions.
Hi, Diana, this is Pam with Alaska Community Action on Toxics. I have a couple of questions maybe to get us started while the shy people speak up here. This is a question for David. You mentioned New York City and Malibu having done testing for PCBs. I'm wondering really what it would take for a school district to do comprehensive testing for PCBs in schools. And my second question has to do with the wood preservative pentachlorophenol. And for both of you, are you aware of any testing or research that has shown that this wood treatment pesticide has been used in schools and that it might present an exposure hazard? And thank you very much. Really great presentations.
Well, let me just answer the second question first before I forget it. There's no question but that is a chemical that has been used as a wood preservative, especially in playground equipment, but also some cases inside. It has not been studied as much, and that is a problem. But to go back to the first question about the PCBs in schools, what happened in both circumstances is that there was one parent that was concerned that pushed the school officials, the city officials, and then ultimately EPA to do the testing. It's a very complicated issue. And most school administrators are trying to avoid testing like the plague because of the liability if they find serious elevations in the content of PCBs from the caulk or from the ballast. Now, I don't have great advice on this. What happened in New York City was one parent started it. Then the city decided to do some testing in, I believe it was 5 or 7 old schools, and almost all of them had significant PCBs in the air. They tested the caulk, and they even cleaned up the caulk, and in a couple of the schools, it didn't solve the problem, and then they found the issue with the light valves. But I think this is such a serious issue, and again, not just from schools, but schools are certainly the focus. So my advice would be, you know, if you're a parent that has kids in a school that's old like this, push your school board, because you don't want your kid to suffer cognitive development because of PCBs in the air that they're breathing in.
This is Claire. I'll just add to what David said. It's beyond one parent. There was also a large lawsuit and citywide organizing orchestrated by New York Lawyers for the Public Interest, which is a public interest NGO based and doing work just in New York City. And EPA Region 2, which is in New York City, really needs to be congratulated for sort of working out these what they called intervention studies. Well, what happens if we cover up the ceiling tiles? What happens if we do the caulk that's around the windows and door frames? And how do we deal with the... So one at a time, they took them apart and put them back together again. And for people who are interested, actually, the New York City Department of Education has maintained copies of all the test results in their intervention studies. So those are up online and have been for some time, and really recommend them. David said it's a tough issue. It really is. It is very expensive, very, very expensive. New York City has just agreed to, I think, a negotiated settlement. Hopefully it will fall under its 5-year capital plan, and it is literally billions of dollars.
It was interesting that it lasted.
Identify, remediate, and remove PCBs in a set number of schools.
At last week's meeting, about 10% of the attendees were lawyers. So you can see this is going to be something that involves a lot of litigation, but I'm not sure that's the best way to solve the problem.
I agree with you. I mean, the root of it is it's a legacy building material that's in many kinds of buildings, including hospitals and government offices, and schools are not the only place that have something to attend to.
Thank you. Are there other people with questions out there?
I do. This is Hope Edelman. I'm out here in Malibu, California. David, I was at the PCB conference in Woods Hole with Jennifer DeNicola last week. Thank you so much for your presentation there. Out in Malibu, our PCBs and 8 other toxicants were discovered in the soil during a routine environmental impact report for renovations on our middle school, which is how more schools are actually discovering that they have a PCB problem. We, in fact, have money set aside from a bond issue that could remediate our school, but what's holding us up is a lot of politics. It's not as simple. We have a whole parents nonprofit organization that formed to try to get to press our school district. We've been pressing really hard. And so I'm wondering specifically, Claire, what advice you have for parents that are butting up against political agendas in their own communities? Because one point we made at the Woods Hole conference was that without some kind of standardized oversight for inspection and testing and remediation in schools, if it's left to 15,000 individual school districts, you can wind up with 15,000 individual outcomes depending on each district's political and financial agendas, and not all of them are going to be protective of human health in the long run.
Great question. It's very difficult to be a parent in this situation or a small parent organization in this situation, which is the first thing, and every optimistic parent launches into this and then discovers how complicated the landscape is. EPA itself has published a guideline on PCB remediation in schools, and I would suggest looking at that as a first step. It's a federal guideline. It is not a regulation, but that would be a first step. And I would suspect that given it was published, I think, in 2009-2010, and given the number of studies that have been done since, it might be time for EPA to revise that. And certainly a federal guideline gives you a basis for moving ahead and sort of equalizing the approach across, you know, the thousands of individual school districts, public and private schools as well. Let's not exempt private schools from what's going on here. So it's that would be one step. And for parents who are up against it, I would say only we have advice on our website because it's so commonly requested what you can do about forming a local organization. I think it's very difficult for volunteer parent organizations to come together around tough issues like this. And it really means setting a, you know, a mission statement, some very carefully defined goals and objectives, and sticking together as a group, which turns out to be the toughest thing to do. Parenting is a very competitive sport, and every parent wants their child to have, you know, first-string soccer and first-string math and so forth. And so sometimes parents follow their hearts as opposed to sticking together to solve a district-wide problem, which is very expensive to deal with. I wanted to add one element to David's presentation, which is newer information regarding apparent IQ deficits among children. And I don't want to change the subject too far from PCPs because it's such a great one, but only to let you know that it is now in the literature that high CO2 levels, carbon dioxide levels in classrooms, at or over 1,000 parts per million CO2 lead to a documented decline in executive functioning or critical thinking skills in adults. That means they're not attending to tasks, they're not concentrating, they can't stay focused, they cannot prioritize, and that's at 1,000 parts per million. Well, classroom levels are typically 1,500, 2,500. In the literature, they're reported as high as 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 parts per million CO2 in a classroom. So there are not any studies in this particular area with kids, and it's not understood if this is just CO2 levels by themselves or whether this is CO2 is an indicator of other pollutants which have accumulated in the indoor environment, the chemical stew of the air we breathe indoors. Anyway, so back to you, David, and I really want to thank the Malibu parent for a really terrific question.
This is Laura in Seattle. I was going to ask Dr. Carpenter where we could look for current information on the radio frequency issue, because that one was new to me.
Well, I have a relatively recent review article published in Reviews on Environmental Health. Let me just find the specific. I'd be quite happy to get copies of this to anybody that's interested, but let me get the total.
While David is looking that up, if there are others who have questions, since we are about out of time, you could go ahead and send those to me at diana@akaction.org, and I can make sure that they get to either Claire or David, and I'm sure they'd be happy to respond to those.
Yeah, it's Reviews in Environmental Health, Volume 28, page 159, 2013. And it's a summary of electromagnetic fields in general, but touches all of these issues. And I'd be happy to provide copies to anyone that would need it.
Thank you. We are just about out of time. As I said, you can go ahead and forward your questions on to me at diana@akaction.org. Before we close, I just wanted to give... to thank everyone for participating, everybody who called in, and our speakers, Claire Barnett and David Carpenter, and to ask if either of you would like to make any final remarks before I wrap up the call.
I think I've said everything I need to say.
Okay.
Dealing with school environmental exposures in children is like a perfect storm. You have old school buildings, by and large, existing buildings, existing local political issues, as have been referenced prior to this, and you have children with great vulnerabilities, yet there are no state health departments which actually track or provide any surveillance or coverage when children are at risk or have exposures. This is a wide open territory, and we need a lot more work to happen. And we need a lot more schools to clean up while we're in the middle of researching what's actually happening with children. And I really want to thank ACAT and Che Alaska for giving us the opportunity to share a little bit of information, encourage people to press on.
Well, we want to thank you for your compelling presentations and call to action. So thank you both so much. Thanks, everyone, for calling in. There will be a recording of today's call that will be available on our website. We'll send a link to that. And our next call will be on Wednesday, November 5th. We'll be discussing outcomes of an upcoming meeting in Rome where an international panel of experts will review chemicals being considered for a worldwide ban under the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants. And one of those chemicals, I'm sorry, I did forget the name, Penta maybe, is the wood preservative that Pam Miller mentioned. So don't miss that call. Finally, please remember that you can offset the cost of teleconference fees for this call by donating now at www.akaction.org. Now is a great time to give because we have a matching grant from Groundswell's Catalyst Fund, which means that every dollar you give will be matched dollar for dollar to double your impact. If you have additional